Global COVID-19 cases surpass 30 million. As Europe races to slow a surge in infections, England could be headed for a second lockdown. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. 62% of adults here in England are now commuting to their workplaces, nearly double the number in late May, according to the Office for National Statistics. But the number of new coronavirus infections has been doubling every 7 to 8 days. It all comes on the heels of a months-long campaign urging people to get back to city centers and eat out at local restaurants. Soon, though, there could be a crackdown on all of that, but to what extent? The BBC's Will Bain has that story.
Well, Victoria, we've come to see it as a sign of bad news, really, when the Health Minister, Matt Hancock, is touring the broadcast studio. So as we came into the BBC this morning and I saw him stood outside in front of a TV camera, we were bracing ourselves for perhaps more bad news. And it was certainly a pretty grim outlook that the Health Secretary had to outline.
This is a big moment for the country. We're seeing an acceleration in the number of cases, and we're also seeing that the number of people hospitalised with coronavirus is doubling every 8 days.
Now, businesses will have been worried about the need to get people even now back out into restaurants, out into shopping centres to help kickstart the battered economy. What do we know? What's going to happen from here? Will there be another lockdown that could make that worse?
You're absolutely right, Victoria. Like countries around the world, the UK government is in this really difficult position, trying to balance getting the economy back open and running again and keeping people in work with also trying to stop the numbers of these cases rapidly escalating as we're seeing now. Now, the Health Secretary was perhaps clearer on what won't be happening rather than what will be happening this morning. He was really keen to stress the government will do everything in its power to keep businesses and schools open and running as normally as they can.
We know that the vast majority of transmissions happen in social settings, whether that's in hospitality. And in a way, there's good news in that, as well as, of course, the bad. The good news is that the proportion of cases being passed on in workplaces is relatively low. So protecting the economy, protecting work and protecting schools, these can be done alongside restrictions of our social lives, basically.
So that's kind of what won't be happening. It doesn't look like a blanket closing of everything as we saw at the beginning of the full-on national lockdown. But the government is framing it more as restrictions that could be in place right across England. And we're already seeing that in the UK, Victoria. Some 10 million people in England and Wales are already in local lockdowns. And we know what some of those restrictions are already. So those are things like you shouldn't have anybody who doesn't live in your house over to your house. You can't go to a pub or a restaurant or a cafe with people outside of your house. You have to meet with less than 6 people when you do meet people outside. So there's restrictions like that, curfews on bars and restaurants and when they can open and close. So perhaps that is a picture of what we might see, not just in these localised areas, but we might see that nationwide across England.
The BBC's Will Bain. Thanks for filling in those gaps.
Thanks a lot.
Well, one of the keys to getting economies back to some form of normalcy is a vaccine. The U.S. said it could begin delivering one within 24 hours of FDA approval. But what about the rest of the world? As part of our fast-track vaccine coverage, I put that question to Thomas Cooney, Director General of the International Federation of Pharmaceutical Manufacturers and Associations, who said early doses can be shipped quickly, but logistical challenges remain.
To put this in perspective, global vaccine production is estimated pre-COVID-19 at between 3 and 5 billion per year. That excludes the seasonal flu vaccine. And there hasn't been big surplus capacity because vaccination programs, you know, for children, for the elderly, they continue. This is still one of the most challenging questions, and I wouldn't be surprised if we would find, you know, hurdles, obstacles, which we don't even know yet. For example, you need the syringes, not just the vials. Some organizations are right now doing a global vaccine readiness survey because some countries, even among industrialized countries, may not really be fully up to the task of trying to immunize 80% plus of their population because this has never been done in the past.
We also heard this week from the charity Oxfam, which has warned that wealthy countries representing 13% of the world population have laid claim to more than half of the promised doses of an eventual vaccine. But the question is, if local production ramps up in countries around the world where it's harder to get vaccines, could that alleviate some of the problems around the inequality of distribution?
I do not share their analysis. For example, in their analysis, they leave aside the vaccine capacity of India. Now, India is one of the largest global vaccine manufacturers. China, for example, when you look at India and China, both of them, I expect, will be pretty fast in terms of their vaccine programs. There you already have about one third of the world population covered, and that's left aside by Oxfam. It is true one of our concerns is, for example, how to make sure that you also reach African countries. That's why the mix of high-income countries buying into this solidarity facility, the COVAX, as cross-subsidizing poor countries is so important. But at the same time, months ago, many people thought that the region most exposed and most vulnerable to COVID-19 would be Africa. When we look at it, let's say the US has been hit much harder, many parts of Europe, parts of Latin America. One reason may be that the African population is much younger. One reason may be that they are better used in dealing with pandemics. But let's say it's not the disaster which many people were afraid at the beginning. But we really need to make sure that the vaccines reach the people who need them.
Thomas Cooney, the Director General of the International Federation of Pharmaceutical Manufacturers and Associations. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks a lot, Victoria.
More of that interview online at marketplace.org later today. A quick check of financial markets now. Global stocks are little changed. The pan-European Stock 600 index is flat. Benchmarks in Asia ended up as much as 0.5%. 5,000 travel and tourism companies and their workers have written today to European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen asking for traveler quarantine restrictions to be replaced with an EU-wide testing protocol. That's as air passenger travel remains at ultra-low levels around the world. Some airlines, though, are coming up with creative ways to encourage would-be travelers to spend money on flights to nowhere. The BBC's Shama Khalil has that story.
Qantas has promised passengers great views of Australian landmarks like the Sydney Harbour, as well as the Great Barrier Reef and Uluru on what has been described as the boomerang flight. Some of the locations have been off-limits to many people due to COVID-19 border closures. The company's CEO, Alan Joyce, said the flight meant more work for the airline's employees. Qantas has lost nearly $1.5 billion and froze thousands of jobs since the pandemic began. Mr. Joyce has been vocal in his opposition to blanket state border closures and accused leaders of being driven by politics and not health advice.
The BBC's Shaima Khalil reporting from Sydney there. Now, it's not just Qantas. Airlines in Taiwan, Japan, even Singapore have played with the flight to nowhere model. Let us know if you'd take one. We're at the hashtag BBC Marketplace on Twitter. In London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.